My dear friends, a very sincere, heartfelt welcome to you. Thank you so much for coming. Let's start with a few ohms or ohms. Deep breath. Couple more times. And now, my dear friends, in praising God, God doesn't become holy, we become holy. Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah, Allah. Just as sisters of Allah. The brothers. Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah, the family of Allah. Allahu Allah, Allahu Allah, Allah. Allahu Allah. Once softly. Allahu Allah. Allahu Allah. Twice aloud. Allahu Allah. Allahu Allah. Allahu Allah. Once again, my dear friends, a very heartfelt welcome, and so wonderful to hear that we have friends from Peru, from TWSP, from Whidbey Island, and other places also. So thank you very, very much for being present here. And I'm so honored and delighted that we have John and Tova. Besides being very accomplished musicians, they're also spearheading and in collaboration with others, initiating and sustaining a very beautiful, profound spiritual program, which is of national proportions, which is economic in nature. Whenever I think of John and Tova, I think of these insights we all know about. That we are the ones we have been waiting for. That we can make a difference. But we must believe it. And thirdly, this will happen if we truly awaken. And particularly if we become aware of our patterns. So I have to repeat to you this mullah story. Maybe for the 9th time, I think. I think up to 10 times it's allowed. If you remember, the mullah, he goes to work. He opens his lunch pail box. What does he find? A cheese sandwich. Second day, third day, fourth day, fifth day, it's always a lousy cheese sandwich. On the 10th day, he says, I'm getting sick and tired of this lousy cheese sandwich. So his puzzled co-worker said, Mullah, why don't you ask your wife to make you another kind of sandwich? You can be assertive a little bit. He said, I'm not married. Who makes them? I do. So reflect on that with regard to this national program I'm talking about. Here we are railing against, criticizing, you know, advocating for bringing down these corporations that are based on greed and power. And yet, because of our unawareness, we are the ones who have created the monster. We are the ones who are sustaining them. We are the ones who are feeding them. So in the sharing time, I'll ask John and Toba to say a few words about this program called Intera. You see, it's important to know that we, very often in our lives, we are overlooking the obvious. So again, Mullah's story, if you remember, the Mullah is crossing the border with his donkey. On his donkey, the guards check him, you know, for any smuggling items he's bringing in. Why? Because every week he's getting richer and richer and richer. He must be smuggling something. They turn him upside down, they check his saddlebags. Nothing, no contraband, but how come he's getting so rich? Finally, after the statute of limitations is over, after many years, the inspector of the customs says, okay, now you will never be prosecuted. What was it you were smuggling on your donkey? He said, I was smuggling donkeys. So important to really become aware of that. What am I missing in my life that's so obvious? Okay, another subject. Karen informs me this is, for our church today, is the World Religions Day. And we are Interfaith Community Church. We sincerely honor all paths to that inexpressible, incomprehensible, that great mystery. And we want to say that in every single tradition, there are truths and untruths, as Gandhi said. And if you remember, Gandhi always said with a wink, especially your own. In every religion, we have truths and untruths. But at the heart of every tradition, at its core, are some very beautiful, very profound spiritual teachings. See, it would be incorrect, in my opinion, as for some people, as they're writing books and just focusing on all that are the untruths about every religion and saying, throw religion out. Or for people, sometimes like me, focusing only on the spiritual aspect and forgetting the untruths. We have to have a balance. We have to become aware of that. But what is important to realize is, as all the great teachers say, that differences exist among religions, but to fight over them, to kill over them, as Rumi says, it's all about illusions and vanities. So I want you to stay with that. These fighting over differences, which exist, but this fighting over them is about illusions and vanities. You know, Ramakrishna from India, that 19th century saint, he would say, we human beings are so used to partitioning land, the earth. The entire planet is partitioned into boundaries. But you can never partition the sky. And God is spacious like the sky. God actually is greater than any one religion. That's why we say in interfaith, interfaith is not about conversion. Interfaith is about completion. About becoming a more complete human being. A more evolved person to evolve into the fullness of our being. Interfaith provides a most essential path to that. In any case, we have to honor God's diversity. So let me just few words about some traditions. First, just to get a sense, to have an, as Gandhi would say, to have an appreciative understanding. And just maybe some of the teachings would splash in your chest. It would benefit you. Let's take Hinduism, for example. What is the crux of Hinduism? There are two main, you might say, equations for Hinduism. One is the Hindus say, Atman equals Brahman. In plain English, it means that if through some path, that Hinduism is very spacious about it, through some path, doesn't matter what path it is, what tradition you choose, what journey you take, somehow, if you are able to connect with your soul, Atman, with your Christ nature, Buddha nature, Allah nature, Elohim nature, Krishna nature, if you can connect with that, you usher magically, astoundingly into Brahman, into that which is inconceivable, indescribable, unutterable. In the name of Him who has no name, but who appears by whatever name you call her. That great mystery. In fact, Kabir, a Sufi, he explains it this way. When that happens, and the point of Hinduism is that it is possible in your lifetime to connect to your soul and to usher into that astounding space that Buddhists would call Nirvana, for example. Brahman. So Kabir, that wonderful Sufi mystic, he says, it's like this, it's not that the drop goes into the ocean. The ocean goes into the drop. That's what happens. Atman equals Brahman. And the Hindus say, this is in your power. You can do it. And they're talking from an experiential perspective. That's the first half. Second half is, how do you get there? The journey, the path I mentioned about. There are many, many paths, but Hindus say there are four major paths. You can be a yogi, which is the path you're on. Yoga means to be in union, to yoke with. You can be a bhakti yogi. Keep the name of your Lord spinning in the midst of all your activities. Just that much. So Hindus say, for example, Christianity is bhakti yoga. True Christianity. There is karma yoga. Someone might say, you know, this is too airy-fairy for me. I like action, results, to help the poor, to make structural changes. Yes, say the Hindus, you can achieve and usher into this Brahman if you engage in karma yoga. Karma means work, action, action, action yoga. On one condition, that you do this work without being attached to the fruits of the work, money or prestige or power. That's karma yoga. But through this path, you achieve the same as you would do through bhakti yoga. It can be through jnana yoga. Somebody might say, oh, that's nice, but I'm more the intellectual type. That's called jnana yoga. Use your intellect. But as the Sufis say, that requires that you move from a knowledge of the tongue to a knowledge of the heart. As the Quran says, the heart never falsified what it saw. And that's quite a process. That's jnana yoga. That's through the intellect, but moving from a knowledge of the tongue to a knowledge of the heart. And the last category is raja yoga. Meaning, I might say, I prefer to be engaged in psycho-spiritual exercises. Let's say like silence, meditation on a very regular basis. Sure, do that. Do that with sincerity. Do that with persistence. Do that with what, again, Sufis would call increased necessity. And you remember this wonderful verse? If you are in silence, how powerful it is. All the theologies of the world are as nothing compared to one whisper of the Beloved. So Rumi, be silent that the Lord who gave thee language may speak. For as He fashioned a door and a lock, He also made a key. So which kind of yogi are you? Each path is very valid. And you probably, like I am, a combination of different paths. But you probably want primarily. So, I love, for example, this prayer in Hinduism, which is very often misunderstood by Muslims, actually, and people of other traditions, who call Hindus idol worshippers. And they try to explain these idols that they worship are representation of that one Brahman, of that one God. So this is a prayer which I love to say in this, in our community here, a very simple prayer said by the poorest of the poor in India, the peasants, the Hindu peasants. You know, they in a small little hut, they have these little idols or a particular god or goddess or combination of them. And he starts his prayer, or she starts the prayer by saying, "Oh God, please forgive me for 3 shortcomings. It's because I'm human. I understand that you are omnipresent. I cannot grasp that. I don't understand what that means or how it is even possible. All I beg you, I plead, please be present in this little hovel, little hut of mine. I understand that you are beyond gender, beyond form. I have no idea what this means or how it is even possible. All I beg you is please be present in the form of this 2 or 3 gods and goddesses I have here. The last one is, I'm told that you are beyond praise. I don't understand how that's possible. All I beg you is please accept my symbol, sincere praise. Please come, but there's some place for you somewhere. So maybe about Hinduism, I'll just say one more thing about Hinduism. I love their description of God. So if you ask a Hindu philosopher, how do you describe God? Of course, we know that words cannot contain that description. But the Hindu description is so beautiful. They say about God, the eyes cannot see God, or the great mystery, but it is that by which the eyes see. The tongue cannot utter it, but it is that by which the tongue utters. The mind cannot think it, but is that by which the mind thinks? And so it goes on and on and on. So just be with that for a few moments. That's really having a heartfelt appreciation of the most beautiful teachings of Hinduism. Let's move on very briefly to Buddhism. Now, Buddha is, of course, a title. It's not the name of that person. Buddha simply means the awakened one, the one who is aware. We're asked to become aware. And very quickly, you know, just for your knowledge or your learning, 4 Noble Truths, 8-fold Path, the whole point being a Buddhist would ask or say that, yes, my friends, there is suffering in this world. The cause for suffering is attachment to the created world, to that which is impermanent. And everything in the created world is impermanent. Everything changes. And if you become attached to that, as it changes, you become disappointed. You suffer. Tanha, you suffer. Next point in the 4th Noble Truths is, 3rd one is, but there's good news. And the good news is, follow the 8-fold path, and you'll achieve what is called mukti, freedom. See, in Hinduism and Buddhism, the goal is to achieve moksha, to become freed. That's the greatest aspiration of a human being. Can I become free, free, free? Can I achieve moksha? Can I achieve the state of mukti? So if you follow the 8-fold path, says the Buddha, you will become freed. And that's your deepest, profoundest need and aspiration. If you do what? If you can practice and engage in right understanding. There's a lot there. I mean, we can have a whole seminar on that. Right aspirations. Right speech. See, that's very important in our culture. Right speech. Right conduct. Right livelihood. Don't say my livelihood has no connection to what I believe. It's just a living I do. I make. I don't believe in war, but I work for creating. I work for manufacturing missiles or weapons. It doesn't work that way. You have to have the right livelihood. You have to be aligned. Right effort. Right effort. Right mindfulness. And lastly, right meditation. The Buddha says it is difficult to achieve enlightenment or freedom without practicing some form of meditation. I like the story when someone asked him, what have you gained from meditation? He said, nothing, absolutely nothing. I said, why do meditation? He said, because let me tell you what I have lost in meditation. I've lost my fear of death. I've lost my anxieties. I've lost my neurosis, my psychosis, psychosis, because of meditation. And by the way, something we repeat almost every time we are here, and this is true in several traditions, about the greatest kind of meditation. Do you remember what the Buddha said? The Buddha said, of all the footprints, the footprint of the elephant is the most supreme. Of all the meditations, the meditation on your own death is the most supreme. See, it's validated. The meditation on your own death. So Prophet Muhammad, as a part of his regular practice, would visit graveyards very, very, very regularly. Not because it would give him a sense of morbidity. It would make him more awakened to life. And as some of you know, just before he died, the day before he died, he spent almost a whole night in a graveyard, praying in a graveyard. Now the Buddha was asked many, many times about, tell us about God. Tell us about angels, about spirits on the other side. And each time, what did he do? He chose to remain silent. So he said, they said, why are you not saying? Tell us about it. We want to know about it. He says, I only speak about that of which I have personal experience. Then they said, are you telling us there is no heaven, there is no other side? He said, I didn't say that. In fact, he said, let me tell you, there is a nirvana. A nirvana which is unborn, uncompounded, unmitigated. An escape from the born, compounded, and mitigated. And yes, it is filled with eternal bliss. Think about it. It's the same thing as we talk about heaven or godliness. That's nirvana. And then the people said, wait a minute. How do you know this? Because you told us experience. He said, I know, I'm telling you that because I have been there. Then what are you doing here? And his famous words, if you will know this, he said, I came back for the liberation of all sentient beings. So see, that's good news. Here's a person talking from personal experience that there is a nirvana. Have hope. You know how important hope is. I have to tell you a mullah story again. And it's very metaphorical, allegorical. The mullah is on a train journey. A train and a journey to a certain destination. And he notices the ticket conductor coming. Do you remember? He gets scared. He begins to look for his ticket. And where does he look? In other people's pockets. In other people's suitcases. What are you doing? I'm looking for my ticket. Why don't you look in your own pocket? He says, I could do that, but if I look inside my pocket and there is no ticket, I shall lose all hope. Just be with that for a few seconds. It has many levels of meaning, this particular story. Okay, to come back to the Buddha, along the same lines and the same topic I was talking about, the Buddha explained further. He said, it's like this. Let's say you have been shot by someone with an arrow and you are dying. And here comes the doctor. The doctor comes to help you. You tell the doctor, before you help me, let me ask you, the person who shot the arrow, what was his nationality? Was he brown, black, yellow, or white? Was he from a good family or bad family? What caste does he belong to? Buddha says, if by the time all the answers would be given, you'd die. So his point is that instead of asking all these intricate questions about the other side and this and that, just be present with what is. Take the arrow out of your body. Be present with what is. I love the verse from the Buddha's sayings talking about this attachment, which is the cause of suffering. And by the way, it is attachment to that which is changing. Attachment to form, not essence. His beautiful verse is talking about each one of us. The pursuer of desire pursued. The pursuer of desire pursued. Like a hunted rabbit you run from life and harried and so stressed from life to life to life to life. So where do you start? What do you do? The most important thing, as the Buddha says, let me quote his wonderful famous words, we are what we think. Everything that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make our world. Speak or act with an impure thought or mind, and sorrow follows you, just like the wheel follows the oxen cart. Speak and act with a pure mind, and happiness follows you, just as your shadow follows you. The Buddha says, health, contentment, and trust. Health, contentment, and trust are your greatest possessions. Health, contentment, and trust are your greatest possessions, but your greatest joy is freedom. Your greatest joy is freedom. The verse I love by Thich Nhat Hanh, the miracle is not to walk on water, the miracle is to walk on land. And the Buddha, as he was dying, what were his last words as he was dying? He continued his teachings till his last breath. And with that he took his last breath. His last words were, be a lamp unto yourself. Be a lamp unto yourself. Work out your salvation with diligence. Work out your salvation with diligence. Okay, moving on. Time has passed. So let me quickly just give you one verse from, let's move to Tao Te Ching. Just let me think of one central teaching from Tao Te Ching. I have only three things to teach you, says Lao Tzu. Simplicity, patience, and compassion. Simplicity, patience, and compassion. Simple in word and actions, you return to the source of being. Patient with friends and enemies, you accord with the way things really are. And the most important one, the most critical one, you can spend a lifetime thinking about it, pondering, reflecting on it. Compassionate towards yourself. I repeat, compassionate towards yourself. You reconcile all beings in the world. I repeat, compassionate towards yourself. You reconcile all beings in the world. What can I take from Islam? Maybe I'll just take some words from Prophet Muhammad. Prophet Muhammad said, the true teacher kindles the light. The oil is already in the lamp. He says, it is better to blush in this world than in the next world. This is one I love very much. If a person gives up quarreling, if a person gives up a quarrel when the person realizes that he or she has been in the wrong, the person will find a beautiful mansion built for this person in paradise. A mansion for this person will be built in paradise. But if a person gives up a conflict, even though he is in the right, a mansion will be built for this person in the loftiest of paradise. Prophet Muhammad said, in his time, 7th century, with a lot of fighting Jews, Muslims and Christians, Prophet Muhammad said, anyone who wrongs a Jew and a Christian, or a Christian, will have me as his accuser on the day of judgment. Prophet Muhammad's beautiful words are this about what is most important in life. He was asked, what is most important in life? He said, three things are most beautiful. One is that you always be humble. And I forget the exact word, how it's in English, in the vicissitudes of fortune, ups and downs of fortune. That's one. Number two is that you really pardon and forgive when you are in a position of power. And the third thing he said, the most beautiful thing, is to be generous without any conditions attached. These are the three most beautiful things. So let me end with a story which comments on this verse, a beautiful verse in the Quran which says, everywhere you turn is the face of Allah. Everywhere you turn is the face of Allah. For me, that's the best way to celebrate World Religions Day. Every so where you turn is the face of Allah. So the mullah is in the grand mosque in Mecca. I've been there, by the way, many, many times because my father was posted to Saudi Arabia as a diplomat. So we used to go to Mecca quite often. And it was really an amazing experience to be in the grand mosque, where the Kaaba is. Kaaba is the symbolically the house of God. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's a square structure draped in black, which Muslims say built by Adam and Eve and also by Abraham and Ismail. And there's a black mysterious stone in one of the corners, which is a meteorite. Anyway, it's metaphorically, as I said, the house of God. When Muslims pray, in what direction do they pray? In the direction of the Kaaba, where that's symbolic structure is. So if you go in the mosque, it's really an awesome, extraordinary feeling to be there, because there's so much energy. People, all Muslims from all over the world, are facing in that direction, praying five times a day. And in that grand mosque itself, day and night people are praying to Allah, but in the direction of Kaaba, as a symbol of the exile's greatest aspiration is to return home into mystery. So the story is that a mullah is in the grand mosque, and he falls asleep, and his feet is pointing towards the Kaaba. This angers the Meccans, the people in Mecca, saying, "How dare you point your feet towards the house of God? That's God's house, symbolically." So mullah says, "Oh, forgive me, but please do me a favor. Pick up my feet, please, and put it in the direction of the place where Allah is not." And they all left him alone. So with that, my friends, let me end with a Christian, a wonderful insight by a Christian philosopher who said, "We learn from history that we do not learn from history." So with that, just spend a few moments just reflecting on what has been said. And we're going to go into a very short meditation. And for this meditation, I'd like to start with a chant. For some of you, it's a new one. Subhanallah. Please repeat after me. Subhanallah. S-U-B-H-A-N. Subhanallah. Meaning, there's a verse in the Quran which says, "To God belongs the most beautiful names." It means, oh God, yours is the glory. Yours is the glory. Subhanallah. Subhanallah. Subhanallah, 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 subhanallah. Subhanallah, 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 subhanallah. One more time. Subhanallah, 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 subhanallah. Please close your eyes now. And for a few seconds, kindly focus on your nostrils and just be present with your breath. Just breathing in and breathing out. Just this much. Let go of this now, and this time kindly bring your attention to rest on your heart. The Quran says, "Allah is Zahir and Batin, outside of you and inside of you." A mysterious but profound verse, absolutely profound verse from God to Prophet Muhammad is when God says, "I was a secret treasure I was a secret treasure, and I longed to be known. I was a secret treasure, and I longed to be known. And so I created the worlds, visible and invisible. Another familiar revelation from God to the Prophet Muhammad, God says, I cannot be contained in the space of the earth. I cannot be contained in the space of the heavens, but I can be contained in the space of the pure, loving heart of my servant. Just be with your heart, connecting to your divine nature. To your heart, please tell, say, declare, silently but feelingly, I love you. I love you, or I'm willing to love you. Again and again, please. I love you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Expressing your praise, your feeling, your gratitude to your heart. Divine heart is in human heart. Just a few times as you focus on the heart now, let's gently chant to the heart, Subhanallah, O God, yours is the praise and the glory. Subhanallah, 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 Subhanallah. Subhanallah, Subhanallah. One more time. Subhanallah, Subhanallah. Subhanallah, Subhanallah. And just stop saying anything at all. Just be with your heart as I count numbers, we'll come into awareness. Number one, slowly, easily, gently coming into awareness. Number two, feeling a sense of connectedness with your divine nature in your heart. Feeling a sense of assuredness, a sense of empowerment, a sense of healing, a sense of ease. Feeling a help within you. Number four, becoming aware that you are the beloved of the beloved. All is perfectly well. And number five, at your convenience, ever so gently, opening your eyes, please.